Before we get started,
okay.
I saw a, I think it was a Facebook status or a tweet maybe that you made the other day.
Really?
About a skee-ball league.
Oh, yes, yes.
And I need to hear more.
I'm a member of a skee-ball league. It's actually, I think it bills itself as being the world's first skee-ball league.
Oh, wow.
Which may or may not be true. I'm not going to argue with them.
You are a pioneer, Will.
Well, no. This skee-ball league has been around for like 10 years, so I'm not a pioneer.
Yeah, but
I just joined my roommate's team.
Ah, you're part of it. Take some credit.
Yeah, we actually did pretty well at the last game.
Wait, so you do teams in this league?
Yeah, it's a lot like bowling league, except for way stupider.
Nerdier. Except much nerdier.
Well, it's almost less nerdy, though, because the scoring system is way more simplified. Like, there's all these averages things that you do in bowling leagues, and things go up and down, and like, even bowling scoring is kind of complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
In skee-ball league, we each play 10 games, and so there's three people on a team. We play 10 games, which means you've thrown 90 balls every night, and then you just divide your entire score by 10, because all of the points, like, 10, 20, 30 points, right? You just divide your score by 10, and then you add your teams up, and you just compare your team scores at the end of the night.
That works.
Yeah, and we won like 683 to like 675. Like, it was neck and neck.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Stressful. That's intense. But you don't know until the end.
Yeah, you don't really know. You can kind of pay attention, and like the whole night, I mean, I'm not great at math, but I was doing some averages, and I was just rounding like the nearest 50s, I think, and trying to keep track, and I could tell that we were about neck and neck. I think my best game was a 300 or 30. Which is not great. Not great.
Yeah. But I guess I don't... I have no... The problem with skee-ball is not everybody uses the same scoring system.
Well, they're usually pretty much the same, aren't they?
Yeah, there's like the 10, 20...
So there's that... There's like that... I mean, you can mess up and throw it and not get any points because it can fall in a little... But that's very, very difficult.
Yeah, that's actually harder than getting 100.
If you get the ball to go up the ramp, you're almost guaranteed, or like, you're definitely going to get at least 10 points. Which is like that bottom ring thing. And then there's the circles going up the middle, and there's like a big circle, and that's 20, and then a little bit smaller one inside of it, which is 30, and then 40 and 50 inside it, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
And then on the top right and left corner is 100.
Isn't the dead center one in the middle 100 too?
No, that one is actually, that was 40. And then right above it is 50. And my throwing style, if we can go into this a little bit further, involves banking it off of the side. So like I find a spot, there's actually like a little chip in the lane we were using, because it's really, there's only two in this bar, there's two skee ball lanes. There was a chip, and if I hit it at about the same speed each time in there, I could sink it in the 40 pretty much every time. The problem with that is if you throw it too hard, it hits that and then it bounces before it hits the jump, and then it like hits the frame and comes back at you.
Oh, and then you look like a big loser.
You look like a big loser, and I thought, like, because I'm new to this, I thought maybe that means you don't get a throw again, because that seems fair. Like, you fucked up, you don't get a throw again. But they totally just let you. My teammate said you have to throw behind your back. But I totally sunk a 50 behind my back, so it was like, you know, just brush my shoulders off and walk away. No big deal.
You should start throwing behind your back every time.
Yeah,
well, congratulations on being a winner.
Thank you very much. We played against a different team. The other two teams that were playing in the lane next to us, their scores were each like 900. So
so next
they were,
week.
They were significantly better.
Next week you're done for.
Yes, probably. To say. Probably.
Yeah. Speaking of, I won a fantasy game the other day.
Did you?
We talked
did
about
you?
Fantasy football earlier.
Yep.
Finally did it.
You finally did it?
I think I might have two wins. Maybe just
I should check my league. I should check my league because this is week 5, right?
Something like that. Yeah, week 5, or maybe we just finished week 5. I think.
Yeah, the first 4 weeks I won, so no big deal. You know, I'm just really good at this fantasy football thing.
I think you just play with really bad people.
No, I'm pretty sure everyone in my league actually knows stuff about football.
That's true. I guess I keep making this blunder where I forget to check. And then my players end up being on a bye week.
See, I was clever enough to catch that in between week 3 and week 4, but then I forgot to between week 4 and week 5. So
yeah, I caught it. I caught it between week two and three, and I keep forgetting after that.
Yeah.
Mm. But I pulled off a win.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
The good Pennsylvania you. Paternos. Yeah, so what else have you been up to?
Not a whole lot. It's a pretty busy weekend of getting some work done, trying some different things out. You know, pretty cool. Quiet for me, though. I had a pretty quiet weekend. How about you?
I had a very exciting and inspiring weekend up in Nisswa, Minnesota, at the AIGA Minnesota Design Camp.
Ah, what is that?
That is a conference held up once a year at the Grandview Lodge, sponsored by the AIGA Minnesota chapter. They bring in a bunch of keynote speakers and quite a few people to host workshops. And then they just get a bunch of creative people to come up and learn about it and talk to each other and mingle. And I guess you can say network if you want to use that word.
I've never wanted to use that word.
I don't either. Make some friends, I guess. I made some friends.
Yeah, good. Did you actually camp at this or not?
No, we stayed at the Days Inn.
Yeah.
Stayed with some other students, my friends Dom and Nico. Stayed with them.
Cool.
And then, yeah, so some of the people that were keynoting were Paula Scher, kind of famously known for developing the Citibank logo on a napkin.
Yeah, that's a pretty...
Yeah.
Her, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag story, right? Because on one hand, it makes designers look lazy. Like, yeah, that was so easy, does. You did that in 2 minutes on a napkin. But on the other hand, it's a pretty awesome logo. It's pretty well done.
Yeah. And she didn't stop at the napkin. She did a bunch of other stuff, for the record.
That's true.
And realized the napkin was right.
Yep.
But I'll tell you what, she was pretty basic, kind of just walked us through her work.
Mm-hmm.
Talked to us about, you know, working hard and it'll pay off. She talked a little bit about how when you're young, it's really easy to have a breakthrough because you don't know anything.
Okay, I'll give you that.
And the older you get, the harder you have to work for the breakthroughs.
Okay.
But if you don't get them, you'll end up just sitting on a plateau.
Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of the I'm talking about my work talks.
No. Sometimes I wasn't they're crazy fun, about
but,
it.
But often they're not great.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of neat, but at the same time, I was like, I've seen it all. Yeah. Like, you're a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Like, we already know that. And, like, seeing some of your process is all right, but Seth Johnson gave a really good talk at, it was actually an AdFed thing, which AdFed is this similar group, but more geared towards advertising. He gave this really interesting talk that was aimed at students that were about to graduate and young professionals. And essentially, it was like six mistakes that he made and things that he learned from them, or like six main life lessons that he didn't learn in school.
Yeah.
And in it, it was like basically like, here's six projects I did. But each one was kind of an interesting story about how he overcame some problem or learned something new. And it was really interesting and way more inspiring than, you know, some of the,
like, yeah,
here's this work I did, here's some more work I did. That was a fun piece. All right. Well, any questions?
That's where I'm going to move into the second keynoter, okay. Eric Madsen.
Mm-hmm.
This is my first time at Design Camp, but yep. I talked to a couple guys who had been there since its birth in the 80s.
Wow.
And they said that in all their years coming, that was the most inspiring talk about design they've ever seen. Wow. And he talked about his, like, it's hard for me to even try to reiterate it because it was so great, but talked about his career and all the cuts he's made and all the cuts he's missed and all the cuts he hopes to make in the future and how that impacts his work. So he talked about, like, you know, going to college and his first job at an ad agency and getting drafted for the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting, you know, lucky he didn't go to Vietnam. He went to Europe. And just some of the struggles that brought trying to come back into his career. And it was just, he was really honest with all of us and just told us what he'd been through as a designer and how it impacted his work. And I mean, people were in tears. It was a little bit bizarre because it was a new way of approaching a keynote, but very, very inspiring. Insanely inspiring.
Hmm. Cool. Good to hear.
So yeah, that was great. Chip Kidd was also there. guy was kind of just this big show. He was just a show. He was silly and made everybody laugh and had a lot of jokes. So, I mean, that was fun to keep you awake, but
did you learn anything?
Much more than that. Not really. That makes sounds sense. Bad, but I was mostly impressed when he showed some work that some other designers had done for him. I was really excited about. And those designers ended up talking later, so we'll get to that.
Oh, excellent. Okay, good.
And then also, another really pretty neat speaker was Simon Collinson. He's a web designer from England. Very laid-back guy. Real cool. He's a part of Brooklyn Beta, which I hadn't heard about until this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big old conference in Brooklyn for web designers and developers. Wait, and
Brooklyn or Brookline, Massachusetts?
Brooklyn.
Like in New York?
Yeah.
Okay. Because there is a Brookline, Massachusetts.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know.
All right. Just making sure. I just wanted to make sure.
I have family that live there. Yeah. Brooklyn. Sorry. And so, yeah, he's part of that, which is a pretty cool thing that's happening. He talked about goals as well.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much said goals are really neat. But more importantly, you need to be willing to follow the forks in the road. Because he actually, interestingly enough, started as an artist, a visual artist, working in Iceland. He was working in Iceland. And then in a roundabout way, got into web design. And now is a pretty top dog in the English web design community.
Web design community, as they say.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a pretty good talk. One of the other big things that kind of spoke to me as somebody who kind of fights against web design because I'm worried that it's going to kill paper is...
make big enough turd noises for that.
Yeah, I know. But what he said is, and it was obvious, so obvious, but I'd never really thought about this way, is, you know, web is not paper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, like, for some reason, you know, in school, people are like, well, paper's going to die because of the web. And it's like, paper might die, or paper will take on a new, will start doing something else.
The conversation so about it needs to be different. About what the goal of the thing is. And like, newspapers are outdated because they're not better than digital distribution in any way. Except that they're expensive to run. And since they're expensive, generally, hopefully the quality is better. But that's not true either.
It's not true.
I mean, I think it's a commonly held idea, though.
But we can all agree that like a wedding invitation is far nicer to receive on paper.
Can we agree? I don't agree.
I think we can.
I'd rather
you
be.
Don't. You would. I'm gonna invite you to my wedding with an Evite.
Yeah, if you send me it on a computer, I can click accept. It goes in my calendar. It's ready to go.
Shut
There's
up.
No more thoughts. I can RSVP. I can RSVP in 2 seconds. I can see.
Yeah, you can RSVP in 2 seconds.
I can buy my gift right away because you've linked to your registry. And I.
You can do that with a paper invite too. Just put the website on.
Yeah, that's terrible. I don't want to have
to
type a URL.
If you invite me,
I don't want to type a URL into my browser, especially if it's going to be a wedding URL, and it's going to be like Tom's marrying someone, bigsurprise.weddingwire.com/17,000 unintelligible characters, and there's going to be semicolons, dashes, and I won't know if it's a dash or a hyphen, and then there's going to be slashes, and it's just terrible, just awful.
When I get your wedding email that says Will Imholt is marrying some ugly woman, I'm just going to throw it in the garbage. I'm going to mark it as trash.
Yeah, mark it as spam and get my account banned.
Yeah. Ruin your wedding account. So then you'll have to change your wedding account name to like Willie Imholt.
Willie Imholt at Wedding Wire.
So he was good, really inspiring. Got me kind of excited about web in a new way. And then he showed us his video. Did you watch it? I threw in the show notes.
I have not watched it.
Okay, I'm going to have you watch it
right now. Okay.
And then
we're going to just edit this part to say, yes, I have watched it.
This is John Baldessari's pencil. This is John Baldessari's chair. This is what John Baldessari sees when he sits at his desk. This is a film about John Baldessari, the artist. John Baldessari decided that this film should be narrated.
It doesn't really do this film justice to just play the audio. Go check it out online at YouTube. The video is a brief history of John Baldessari, and you can get a link from our website, verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier.
So yeah, he showed us that video. And
he had no hand in making that.
No. He showed us that because he thought it's a great way to end a keynote before lunch by making people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
B, he found it super inspiring. C, he really enjoyed those three things that John Baldessari said. Talent is cheap. You have to be possessed and you can't will it. And you have to be in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the one thing you can't control is that you can be in the right place at the right time. And so he said, go to the right places, meet with the right people. When you have an opportunity, don't say no. So that made a lot of sense. Yeah.
He also said that the fourth reason he was showing it was that it tied in nicely with the main subject of our podcast today. Appropriation and art. We'll get to that in a bit. Also, earlier, the web is not paper thing also ties in. And that's a pretty big subject that we just kind of skipped over kind of quickly, but that's okay
too. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So
that was Simon Collinson.
Yeah. Great guy.
Anything else kind of stick out from the AIGA design camp?
Yeah. The last keynotists were two of my personal heroes in design. They're
Will
heads
Imholt
of state.
And, oh, okay.
Oh yeah. It was Will Imholt and Will Imholt.
Yeah.
The heads of state, they are these two guys. I'm not even going to say their names because they never say their names and put their names individually on anything,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Which I think is really cool. They're super collaborative. They used Bob Ross as the vehicle for their keynote.
Good. I'm liking
and
where
talked
this is going.
talked about how, each step of the painting, you're trying to get to the happy little cabin of creativity. And they talked about their happy little cabin of creativity, which is they finally worked a while and been able to start a firm together. And they have this little policy where once a month, one of them takes a week off. And they don't like get to go sit at home. They have to like explore like an idea that they've been thinking about with design or with anything really that they've wanted to explore. And they have to do it. And so two of the projects that came out of these weeks of exploration were, one was a Great Gatsby poster that had the business cards for all four, or for all the people in Chapter 4 of the Great Gatsby that are introduced. And then the other one was a series of posters from cities. And so the kind of the point of that was, you know, work and do your work for your clients, but when you have time, you know, work for things you're interested in. Both these, you know, the idea of city posters was something they're interested in. The Great Gatsby was something they're interested in. So they took the time to do the stuff that mattered for them, which is really great.
Yeah, that's actually pretty common around the San Francisco area. A lot of startups have what they call hackathons, and you could argue whether or not they actually are hackathons, but they'll take mm-hmm. either a day or a couple days. And they'll just all get together, usually at their workplace, and they'll just make stuff. I did hear a design director at one of them talking about a hackathon they had, and there are huge dick quotes about this hackathon because it was like they had to ship, and they moved their ship date forward and said, all right, we're going to have a dick quote hackathon, and everyone stay here and work on this for like the next 20 hours. and it was like their actual work, which is kind of shady. A huge example of that is Bethesda, which is a giant game company that makes this huge mm-hmm. sprawling RPG called Skyrim.
Yeah.
I mean, they make a bunch of games. Skyrim is the fifth installment of this series. And like this is kind of medieval swords and bows and arrows and dragons and such. And after the game shipped, they didn't necessarily have a hackathon, but they had some amount of time, probably a week or two, where they were allowed to just work on whatever they wanted inside the game. And so like some programmer spent a long time like rewriting how the water flowed around rocks to make the water more believable, right? And like that, cool visual update, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Another guy was working with the Xbox Kinect version or the Xbox version, and he implemented some Xbox Kinect features so that you could like shout things that the character in the game would shout, but if you shouted them, it would do it too, like magic shouts and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a cool way of like, you know, clearly that's super focused about tying it to
the game,
the thing you actually make. But I know that there are a lot of places that encourage people to make their own projects. And I'm not in a position to give advice, but I am saying that one of the main things that happens in interviews or in, you know, dick quote networking experiences in San Francisco is that nobody cares about your work experience. They care about the things that you make for fun. And and so, like, you go in and you talk to these companies and they want to know what you're doing for fun, what you're making, and you know,
say
what
ski
you
ball
do.
and they say get out.
You just get out of our office right now, sir.
Botch the interview.
Yeah, that's interesting and important. And I kind of think it's kind of obvious.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. And we'll link to the these two posters I'm talking about, because the Great Gatsby one is it was done on a letterpress by a Minnesota company actually called Studio on Fire.
Very well known.
And the guy,
very, very big.
Yeah.
Also ties in later with our conversation, I think. Not Studio on Fire,
maybe,
but letterpress.
Letterpress. But the guy that was there got to meet these guys, because the guy from Studio on Fire was there as well. And he was telling him how that poster was the most difficult thing he's ever printed, because it's like all these individual business cards printed on one sheet and four colors, and like getting all the type right. And it's just super fine type. Very incredible on both the design part and the letterpress side. So the printing side of it all. So yeah, very inspiring weekend. Got me excited to be back and at my clackety keyboard here.
Clackety keyboard. I think I could beat you in the clackety keyboard measurement.
Yeah, I know. That's because you have like a lead keyboard or something.
There's no lead in this keyboard. There's just lead in the walls of my house.
I don't know what's in your keyboard, but it sounds like somebody's jumping on a tin roof.
Okay, so links to all of these people that you've talked about
will
going to be in the show
notes.
Which is verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier. Also, thewhitehorsecourier.com redirects there, but we don't need to share that because that might go away at some point, and verbmill.net will not.
Verbmill's not going anywhere.
Not going anywhere. Except, oh.
We're going nowhere.
Also, that John Baldessari film is super important, and I'll play a little bit of it during earlier, so by the time people are hearing this, if I leave it in the episode, which I'll probably cut it out, that'll be played a little bit of it. But that's something that people should really watch, because that does kind of tie into what we're about to talk about. We are probably not going to get around to the next commercial on our list of commercials to analyze, which is okay, because it's our show. And also, the show is ostensibly about art and commercials and television and such, so we're talking about art more than commercials today. We are talking...
And also about other interesting things, so we can pretty much talk whatever we want.
We can talk about anything that's interesting. We are talking somewhat about commercial art. Last week, we talked about an e-surance ad. And in the ad, there were hands making mixtapes. And then it was kind of talking about mixtapes and how if you use an insurance agency that doesn't do online stuff, it's basically like you're using mixtapes. It's like the old way of doing things. And I think it was kind of an interesting discussion, because we both started off thinking mixtapes were kind of silly and not really liking them. And maybe we were more disparaging than we meant to be, but we had a very fantastic response from some of our listeners. One specifically, actually. So Chris St. Croix, who is a guy that works at an advertising agency in Newfoundland. He wrote a pretty fantastic blog post called The Art of the Mixtape, which is
He has a pretty fantastic
blog
as well. We should mention that.
Yeah. Well, so let's make sure I get the spelling of this right, because when I was thinking about it, misspelled it. This is Chris St. Croix's blog is CSTCROIX.ca. And The Art of the Mixtape is currently the second article. We'll link to the specific post from our site, but if you just want to check out his blog, he's got some great writing there. And he is a little bit older than us. He has a little more experience making mixtapes, and so he started off just by kind of saying that he thought we were wrong, and then at the end he was like very clearly like, oh, these guys are very wrong about the art of making mixtapes and what is inside of that.
I'm throwing quotes around art.
Art, okay.
Yeah, no.
So there's a lot of things that we should talk about here. I don't really know the best place to start.
I think I'm just going to jump in. I'm going to say right away, mm-hmm. as I read this, he totally changed my mind.
Okay.
During the reading of it, he had this riveting writing style that brought me back to like, Nirvana and like the 90s and whatever life was like for him at that time. And I was totally on board. And then I finished it and I thought about it and I read it again. And I think I go back to where I originally stand and say that mixtapes are not as good as, for sure, CDs, mixes on CDs, and probably not as good as playlists.
And so I agree with you for a lot of reasons. Also, I don't think that there's any part of me that I don't want to demean the quality of making a mixtape, and I don't want to say that it's not. I mean, maybe we could argue about whether or not it's art, but I don't want to say it's not art, and I don't want to say that it doesn't have certain advantages over playlists. But I think playlists have so many advantages. Digital music in general has so many advantages that it's laughably better.
Yeah, I think the other issue is technologically making a mixtape far more strenuous. You know, you're sitting, clicking buttons, making things that, record.
That could be also one of the positives.
That's true. Wait, yeah. Yeah, so if you say that... No, I'm saying that's the positive. Like, they're saying it's technically it's harder, so it takes more work.
Could be positive.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is the actual thought process of putting the songs on the playlist is far more difficult with a CD or playlist. Because with a tape, it's a very linear line. And you can put a pretty subpar song between two really good songs to make it sound good. Whereas in a CD or a playlist, if they randomly play those, each song needs to be good in its own right, and each song needs to sound good in combination with every other song on that playlist. It's like a web versus a line. A web is far more complex to make than a rope.
Okay. Is it so you're saying that if you make a playlist, it has to be good either it has to be good on shuffle and on?
Yeah.
Okay. So shuffle or on straight play or alphabetical play or whatever.
Yeah.
So originally he tweeted at our White Horse Courier Twitter account, which is WH Courier, and he said, "Have either of you ever made a mixtape? Mixtapes were art, not playlists." And that's important because I agree. A mixtape by itself is kind of this singular individual thing. It's not a playlist of music. And a playlist of music is a different thing, and it doesn't have to be as singular because it can be more modular and it can be experienced by more people at the same time. Whereas like a tape, you know, can only be experienced by one player. And I mean, that player could broadcast it, obviously, or could play through speakers, but it's a singular thing. It kind of exists in one place. And then every time you make a copy of it, that copy will degrade in quality. He's got this line here that is early on in his post. He says, "Now there's a certain amount of get off my lawn here. I'm old enough to have actually made mixtapes and used them for years before CD recorders became ubiquitous. The hosts of the White Horse Courier are not that old." And I think it might be worth us talking about some of our kind of musical journeys. And that way we can get kind of an understanding of why we view tapes the way we do.
I'll start by saying, the first tape I ever owned was a sing-along to a book.
Okay.
And the song was There's a Hole in My Bucket, Dear Liza.
There's a hole in my bucket, Dear William.
Dear Liza. Yeah. So that gives everyone a little gauge on how old I was during the tape era.
Okay.
I later went on. I had a couple other tapes, some Garth Brooks ones. And then as CDs became popular, my dad got a truck. with a CD player.
Mm-hmm.
So he converted his music into CD, started buying CDs.
Yep.
And he gave me a lot of his old tapes.
Okay, so, Johnny Cash. You had tapes, but did you have mixtapes?
I made a few mixtapes. I had this red, very, very rough, childish recording device where I could make mixtapes. I basically made a mixtape once that was just Devil Went Down to Georgia and the Folsom Prison Blues over and over and over and over again because I liked those two songs so much. That's the only mixtape I ever really remember making.
Okay, so you never made like an artsy mixtape of like a variety of music that's actually well thought out.
Although, what about CDs? Can I?
Okay, well let's stop there and we'll get to CDs. Yep. So I also never made. I mean, you know, Chris is exactly right. I never made like an artsy real mixtape. I certainly recorded some, and at the time for me they were just playlists. Like it was here are songs I like, and I'm gonna just basically record them in order. Of like ease of recording. Like I didn't think like this song needs to be before this one in this place, you know, and I didn't really spend a lot of time. It was kind of like, oh, this song's coming on the radio. I like, boom, record, you know, and you try to catch it right at the beginning. So for me, they were totally, totally playlists, and they only existed for, you know, a couple of years really, because the transition to CDs was pretty early in my life. And so we got a CD burner, definitely 90s, 2000-ish, right around when they became kind of affordable desktop things, before they were really ubiquitous inside of computers, but when they were things that were distributed and you could buy them and they weren't like $10,000. And I immediately started burning lots and lots of CDs.
Napster.
I mean, this was right around the close of Napster, probably, but I never let that
slip. See, I lucked out. My brother, I was too young. My older brother was pretty, like, big when, like, Napster was at its height.
Napster. So you had this Napster library.
Yeah. It was my brother's, and I always would go on and kind of steal it. And I remember when the whole thing came out about the guy being, like, a criminal, my mom being very angry with us.
Yep.
Mostly with him. And he said to her, and it was one of the best really examples of like what pirated music is. She was like, Luke, you would not steal somebody's car, would you?
And he was like, hold on just a second here. Did she actually say that?
Yeah, just wait.
Okay.
So she's being extreme, like a mom gets when she's angry. And he was like, no, mom, I would not steal a car. But if my friend stole a car and he was making copies of that car in his garage, I would take a copy of that car. And I was like, yeah, pirating music is a good idea. But I don't do it anymore.
Fine. You were a child then. Yeah. Not anymore.
Not anymore. Wiser. Support the
artists.
We won't
get into that argument. I don't believe that she actually said that, because that's such a common meme on the internet, right? Because there are those really cheesy commercials that come before movies like, you wouldn't download a car. And it was like, fuck you, of course I would download a car. There's no part of me that would not download a car.
The commercials say you wouldn't steal a car. Because you wouldn't, but you would download a car.
Yeah.
You know, if they said, would you download a car, you would download it. They would not be a good commercial.
Fantastic reference here to the IT Crowd. You watch the IT Crowd at all?
Yes, I did, but I watched it all, and I haven't watched it in like 2 months.
There's an episode that begins with them watching a movie, and so the episode begins with one of those common, you wouldn't pirate of this.
Yeah. Yep.
We're going to put a link to the to that in the show notes. Don't watch it at work or around your parents. It's actually not bad. It's totally television fine.
Yeah, it's a pretty good show.
So we both did a fair amount of pirating our music when we were children and before the statute of limitations on that crime, or in a way that's not going to get us in legal trouble. There was, you know, a time in our lives when we both downloaded some music. And also, to an extent, shared music via family members or friends. And I in the beginning did kind of an equal amount of that, right? Like, friend brings his CD over and you rip it, or you go to the library and get CDs and you rip it to your computer. Or eventually we got better about it. It was like, friend brings his external hard drive over and we rip gigs and gigs of music at a time. And then of course it's really easy also to get music online. right around. Yeah, so I probably burned CDs for 2 or 3 years pretty heavily. And that was right around the time when I was old enough to not need to ride the bus to school anymore. I also switched to a school that was closer to my home. So I started walking to school, and I would bring a CD player for that. You know, I bought like a $40 Sony CD player.
You couldn't bounce too much as you walked.
Yeah, I remember the first one I had no skip protection, so you had to be really pro to use that. Yeah. And then the second one had like 40 seconds of skip protection, and I was like, all right, yeah, I'm digging this. I can totally mostly walk.
Was that the one that you had to like clamp, like a clam?
Yeah, actually it was that
one. That was the only good skip-proof CD player, I think.
So there were a bunch of those, and I burned a bunch of CDs. And Chris, in this blog post, talks about the art and you know, drawing on the jacket for the tape. I don't agree with him because I think that you do that just as much on a CD.
Oh, yeah, you do.
I think you maybe even, you know, so you have more opportunity on a CD because you can draw on the CD itself. And if you're lucky enough to have a CD player that's got a window in it, you can totally, like, draw some cool stuff that'll look awesome when it's spinning.
Also, I'm just going to say, when I was in high school and early high school ages and stuff, that was my way of wooing ladies.
Mm-hmm.
I would woo the ladies with a mix CD.
No, and you would try to woo the ladies.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I wooed some ladies with mix CDs. I'm going to have them tweet at us to confirm.
All right. If you were a lady that was wooed.
If you were a lady that was wooed by Tom by a mix CD, I can think of like two.
Which is
pretty high on the amount of ladies I've wooed in my whole life. But I would like, you know, pick these CD like songs, like what's the most romantic yet manly yet like unique sounding song that I own, and I'd be putting them on this playlist, and like I wonder what order she's gonna listen to them in, and then she would make one back for me, and
did woo ladies.
Oh yeah, dude, I wooed them and I got music from them. I have tons of music that I got from other ladies that were wooing me back.
Okay.
And,
all right.
And the decoration and the notes I would write in them, so cheesy, but
very cheesy.
Very decorative.
Course, but that's what you're doing. That's part of the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so certainly that happens with tapes. And on tapes, you have one set of constraints because you have this kind of jacket that's bent around the side and a little bit of tape on it.
Yeah.
With CDs, I remember burning CDs for friends, and I would just write a track listing on it because I didn't care, right?
Yeah.
But then, you know, to get that special one that you're going to send, I'm like, well, this person, you know, I normally would just wrap this CD in a piece of paper, but like this person gets a jewel case.
Right? Oh.
Like, I'm going to make an insert for this jewel case.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, big time. And I remember there was a girl that gave me like a stack of 3 CDs, and I didn't really like this girl. but it was like, this is cool. Like she gave me CDs. Wonderful. And like, she drew all over them and went so far as to write like subliminal message free CDs for Will, which I thought was really funny at the time because, you know, terrible, terrible music, just awful.
Yeah.
Did not like any of it.
Oh.
But, you know, still flattering.
Yeah. Nonetheless.
So we both did some CDs. I actually got an iPod when I was in eighth grade, I think.
I got one the same grade.
2004-ish? Somewhere around there. Yeah. I got the second gen iPod. I bought it on eBay and, you know, saved up for a long time to buy it. And when Chris was writing this, there's a specific line, a specific section that I want to quote. This is towards the end. And if you haven't read this already, you should maybe pause the episode and go read the whole article, the whole post. But if you're saving it until afterwards, I'm going to ruin some of the end of it. And he writes, "So you eventually create a physical object that represents a minimum of 60 minutes of your time and possibly hours." And to this, he's referring to like the amount of time it takes to create the actual tape. He goes on to say, "And you give this thing to someone else, or you live with it, and it becomes part of your life for a week or two or four or more. People admire the art and think about why you put that song next to this one. They ask who a band is, and you tell them that you recorded it from that college radio last week, and none of your friends know about them. Maybe you drive around all night listening to the tape, smoking and thinking about life. Or maybe you get laid and then it's your lucky tape and you break it out every time you've got a shot. The tape becomes an object imbued with emotion. How is that not art?" And for me, that is an exact description of my first iPod.
Yeah. Dude, I still have every iPod I ever owned.
I sold my first one when I was going to buy one of my second ones.
Mine broke.
And then I lost one of my second ones. But that first iPod I owned, it was very much a physical object that it didn't represent. In a way it did represent an amount of time because it took me a summer to save up for it.
Yeah.
And like I bought this item and it changed everything about the way I experienced music.
Oh, it changed how I experienced life. I got a mini, the silver mini. I bought used mm-hmm. from a friend for $95 or something. Just got ripped off. And there was not a time in junior high that I didn't have that mini shoved in my pants, right there. And every mm-hmm. night before bed, I'd be charging it.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually went kaput. But I remember in the last days of it, when the battery would die at lunchtime, I'd bring my charger to school and stick it in the orchestra room and charge it during lunch.
Charge it up, yeah.
So I'd have it for the bus ride home.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And even now, I'm 21 years old and I have my iPod Classic 160 gig and I don't leave home without it.
Look at you. Look at you.
Don't leave home without it.
Why don't you get iTunes Match on your phone?
Because I've seen iTunes Match work on your phone and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work at all. It's terrible. Just terrible.
Oh, gross.
So, okay, and then, this part, people admire the art and think about why you put that song next to this one. My first iPod, I didn't play for anyone because it was in a time when there were not thousands of accessories everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, you go to someone's house for a party and there are 6 different stereos there that have iPod docks on them, much less, at least now everyone knows what an aux input is, and they're used to you bringing a device and plugging it in, and it goes to the RCA in the back. When I first had that iPod, that didn't exist.
No.
So it was almost entirely a singular thing. I remember taking some road trips with my good buddy Dave and our families, of course, because we were young, and I had a headphone splitter, and so we would share it together. And that was kind of a cool way to explore music, except for it was a very one-directional relationship because it was just my music on my iPod. But we certainly are at a point where people are sharing music digitally at, I think, a level much higher than they ever did with mixtapes.
Yeah. I think another thing, I'm wondering if you ever did this when you say you never shared music. I would do this sometimes because, I was already wooing the ladies in the CD era.
Mm-hmm,
so mm-hmm. another thing I would do if we were at a hockey game or on the bus or something and I was listening to my music is kind of girls knew at this time in life, I knew about music a little bit ahead of everyone because I had an older brother.
Sure, yeah.
I was listening to Ben Folds when everyone else was listening to 50 sure. Cent.
Yeah.
So I would take one of my earbuds and I'd give them one of my earbuds.
I always hated that.
Forcing them.
I hate seeing it.
Yeah, but wait. When you're in seventh grade and there's a reason for the girl to have to sit next to you for the entire bus ride, that's a big deal.
You could just be charming.
Oh, but I was too busy listening to music. I couldn't talk to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that I was really fat, dude, in seventh grade. It's hard for a fat kid to be charming.
No, it's not. You can tell jokes.
Yeah, but no one sits close to the guy telling jokes. They sit across the aisle from the guy telling jokes.
Many, many times, girls with no interest, or maybe some with interest, would ask to see my iPod, and they would look through all of the songs I have. Right? And that's a kind of personal thing, and it's very similar. It's you're taking this device that holds this kind of expression of this person's taste. And I had a crazy, crazy library of terrible music because I had been downloading music for so long with just no filter at all. It's there's tons of just crap, embarrassing crap. And then there's stuff I liked that was just crap, just terrible. But that object had emotion. My second iPod was my favorite iPod they've ever made, which is the original iPod Video. It was the fifth generation iPod. It was the... So it the iPod Photo had a click wheel and a color screen.
Yeah.
The click wheel being the wheel that debuted on the iPod Nano, where the buttons were underneath the wheel, which is just fantastic, fantastic technology. The iPod Photo, though, still had the square screen, and it could show pictures. You could hack it to run video, but it was really bad, not great. iPod Video, the first one that played video, had a ton of awesome features. The biggest one was that it finally was a hard drive size that was actually like decent. It was an 80 gig drive.
Yeah.
And it supported video output over the headphone jack. That's not a feature that many people used, but no. It was awesome. You buy like a $2 eighth inch to RCA cable, and then you go to anybody's house, you plug in, and you have, I mean, 80 gigs of music and movies you can play. That's totally different from mixtapes, really. But it's still like you've got this modular thing that you're bringing around to show people. And I remember many, many instances of like, we're hanging out, you know, let's watch Futurama. Boom, I've got all of Futurama right here. Let's plug it in. Let's go.
Yeah. Around that time is when people started having like the Bose speakers and all the hookups too. And mm-hmm. you'd come to like, you know, bonfires or parties and things, and it'd be like, hey, Will, you should hook up your music. And mm-hmm. there'd be like this pressure, like, is like, everyone gonna like what I've been listening to lately? Like, what playlist do I put on? I didn't make one for this event. Or like, you know, like, dude, I'm going over to Johnny's house. I'm gonna make a mm-hmm. playlist that'll be perfect for that, for everybody there. And so then it becomes an even bigger web. Like, it can't be a list of songs for one person. It has to be a jumble of songs that can be played in any order that are still going to make all these people happy.
And so Chris writes about the art of a mixtape. And you, like, tell basically, I mean, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but basically you're kind of telling a story. There's a narrative to a mixtape. Mm-hmm. And you follow this flow. And it's this very linear experience. For me, that thing you were just describing is more of like you're DJing either an event or an experience, and it's more modular, but it is still, there's still a level of art to it.
Yeah.
And like, I don't really like DJs all that much, but a good DJ can do wonders to get people dancing or interacting. They can control moods. They can, I mean, and there are instances where you have a person who's in charge of selecting music, and I would call them a DJ, even though they're not playing like dance music, they're doing.
Yeah,
you know, they're trying to control the mood to make sad music, or, you know, it's a dinner and they're just trying to play background music. Certainly, there is an element of that. Also, I definitely had playlists that I made and were for specific instances. So there's like, I'm going back to school. Here's a bunch of songs that are going to cheer me up on my drive to school in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And then like 6 months later, you still have that playlist, because who deletes a playlist? And you're like, oh, yeah, I remember this. I'm totally going to write on.
Here's something I do. I make a playlist every month. But I make it the month before. So, mm-hmm. like, right, so now I'm working on November.
Okay.
And so I think up songs like, oh, this, I really enjoy this, whether a new song or like an old song. Like, oh, this is a good song. I'll listen to it a few times. And then I put it onto the November playlist. Usually these playlists are 70 to 125 songs. And okay. then during that month, I pretty much focus my listening to those roughly 100 songs. And I really like it, get to know those songs. And then after that, like, I'll be sitting around and I keep them by date. And so then there can mm-hmm. be like a time where, like, you know, I was driving past your old place today on my way to your parents' house. And I was mm-hmm. like, what was I listening to this spring before Will moved out? And I started playing mm-hmm. it, and like, it kind of just triggered back those memories, you know? And it was a really nice way to put myself back in that time.
Yeah.
Which is something like with a tape, you lose it. It gets stuck under your chair in your car.
Well, yeah. Okay. You lose it, but then you find it again 6 months later, or 12 months later, maybe. There's that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And I think that can still happen with playlists. One thing that can't happen is the art that's associated with it. So we talked about CDs, and you could argue whether the constraints of tape art, maybe you could say that mixtapes have better art because there's less space, and so it's more controlled. Mm-hmm. And so you have to make better decisions because it's more controlled. And that's kind of this whole argument. It essentially says, like, on a tape, you have to make more decisions, and therefore it's higher quality.
Yeah.
And I could agree to that to an extent, but what do you think about that art thing, that you can't include art with a playlist? Because I have a very specific thought.
I think that Art on a play, on a CD or on a tape is very shallow. In that, if I gave you a mixtape or a mix CD, I don't really know what mixtape. If I gave you a mix CD and I had this like elaborate like threefold like cardboard made die cut like scribbled on everything, more than likely you're gonna take that thing out of the case and you're gonna put it into like a big CD folder. And you might like set that to the side, like that was nice of him to do it, but it essentially becomes like a greeting card. I think they're relatively unimportant. That's what I like. All those CDs that girls gave me, I still have their music. I still have that music in that same playlist in my iTunes and probably on my iPod too. But I don't have any of those horrible jeweled cases.
Jewel cases.
Jewel cases.
An ED on the end of that.
Well, they might have. There are some where the ladies would make hearts out of.
Oh, they actually put their.
Come on,
they bedazzled.
Come
them.
On, this is me here. Getting the bedazzled hearts.
Yeah, admittedly, I never really experienced like high quality art on handmade or homemade recordings. Certainly, I've had CDs. I mean, I haven't purchased many physical CDs in my life. Some of the ones I have, I've kept the cases. Even though there's really no reason to keep the CD because the CD is a worthless piece of plastic. I've kept the cases because it means something to me. I certainly do that whenever I buy a video game that comes in an interesting case, or even if it comes in just a standard plastic. Like, I don't put disc video games in a wallet. I keep them all in their original cases.
That's interesting
to me. With their booklets.
That's interesting to me that you're fascinated with the physical media side of video games, but you're unwilling to print your wedding invites.
I never said I was unwilling to print my wedding invites.
You don't want to print your wedding invites.
I also, I mean, I, you know, let's not plan 10 years in advance or 20 years in advance, Tom.
I'm going to say 35.
But certainly there are advantages to digital invitations. Which means that there are also probably advantages to older forms of media.
Just like
you could still make a mixtape right now, and it would have meaning. If you gave it to me, I would have no way of playing it, and I'm okay with that.
I would not.
I guess
either.
I don't really have a counterpoint to Chris's point about art on the tape, because obviously I think CDs give you, or mixed CDs give you, just as much space for visual art or interesting visual art opportunities as a tape, but that is something that playlists can do. He later goes on to talk about sharing them, and he says, like, you know, how do you even share a playlist? That's also somewhat true, that like if I make a playlist, it's hard for me to give it to you. At least if I make a playlist in iTunes, I can't give you that exact playlist.
And then there's a really...
certainly not anymore.
Well, there's
back in the day, it was a little bit easier with iPods because you could like jam your iPod into someone else's computer and trick it into syncing music, and I could give someone a playlist without erasing their whole iPod.
Well, and then there's this really...
But it was really uncommon.
There's a really like public, kind of gross way of sharing playlists with like Spotify and like 8-tracks and like websites where you make playlists.
I don't think that's gross at all.
Well, it's in the sense of like making a playlist individually for one person. It's very, very different. Okay. Maybe not gross. Very different,
though. Okay.
Not so much Spotify, because you have friends that you're friends with people. It's a network. But 8-tracks, it's just like, here's my playlist. Let the world listen to it.
Yeah. And then that's more about making a group of songs that are kind of good together versus making a group of songs that are expressive about a specific moment, which is what a mixtape in Chris's sense of the word is.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've got... I don't really use digital music streaming services. I've got some friends that use Ardio, and I see kind of what they're listening to on it, and they certainly have playlists, I think, in it that they associate with each other. But there is that removal. I think the kind of control, or the way you make a playlist for yourself or for performance by like hooking up to a stereo... that changes what it is, but I don't think that
takes away from the
art. I don't think
that
means that playlist is not imbued with emotion. it certainly is easier to do technically. And so you can put less thought in and still make something. Or you can put a lot of thought in, but you don't really have to put any work in. Whereas recording on a tape, doing a mixtape, is actually physically work. Like, you have to spend a lot of time doing it. And I'm really lazy, so I'm glad we don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah.
But it makes me think about the amount of work that goes into something versus the quality of it being art.
Not true.
And this is where I want to talk about letterpress.
Okay.
So you talked about Studio on Fire, which is an amazing letterpress shop. They do some fantastic work. They started in a guy's basement. If you know anything about letterpress, that's a hell of a lot of work just to get the equipment into a basement because it's heavy as shit.
But yeah, they are...
I did an internship with a letterpress printmaker. We worked out of her garage. It was her dad's studio before her, and then like he passed it on to her. And she did a variety of things. She did fine art prints, which were often linoleum blocks, reductive cuts, and then some text on top. She also did wedding invitations and business cards. She did her own cards. And a lot of her work was done with handset. Well, I mean, the majority of her work was done with handset type, which is what I was doing. This is like the most intensive, most difficult way to get words printed onto a physical page. It's physically setting each individual letter next to each other in a row. It's upside down and backwards when you're setting it. It's really heavy. The cases of type are really heavy, and they're usually low to the ground or high up, so you're breaking your back as you're doing it. And then your hands get dirty. There's a smell. There's a smell of the chemicals. You have to like mix ink by hand, and then you put it on these rollers, and you roll it over, and you like push this paper in, and you press it just the right way. And it's insane. It's an insane amount of work. And then the result is technically different from what you get when you print something digitally. Like if you make a document, if you make a wedding invitation, and you print it out of your desktop printer next to your computer, it's going to look kind of crappy, right? Yeah. And then if you take it to Kinko's down the road, it's going to look a little bit better. And then if you pay someone who does really high quality printing to print it, it'll look pretty good. And then if you design it to be letterpressed, it's a whole different ballgame. Like physically, everyone can see the difference in quality between good letterpress and good offset printing.
Yeah.
The main difference that most people notice is that you have to print on heavier paper because you're punching it with these metal letters, and it actually embosses the page and like makes an indentation. Strangely enough, when letterpress printmaking was the only form of printing words in mass, punching the page was seen as a sign of poor quality.
Huh.
So you know, newspapers would be set in this. Benjamin Franklin set in, you know, this movable type. Or Gutenberg, setting this movable type, if you will.
Gutenberg,
setting this movable type. The ideal print would kiss the page just enough to transfer the ink, but not enough to actually punch into it and make indentation. What ended up happening is that we replaced that with better forms of printing that work faster and less crisp. I mean, for even now, it's really difficult to get the same quality of printing. And so the uniqueness of letterpress right now is that it does emboss the page, and so that's what people look for, and that's one of the reasons that it is kind of hip. It's one of the reasons it's vogue. I think those words are different.
Well, the issue I'm having with what you just said there is you're saying that the uniqueness is what makes it hip.
Yes.
I disagree.
Okay.
Because I think that what makes it different is the noticeable tactile quality of it.
Yeah.
If you're going to give somebody a paper invitation, if it has this embossed texture and it
that's what I mean.
And it feels, there's more than just it being different.
Even if that's what it is. Yeah. It feels different. You can tell that it's different.
And it feels like somebody, you know, cares.
But the same reason that 3 or 4 years ago it was really popular to put tons of drop shadows on websites, because it was a lot of work.
No, I don't even think that it's a lot of work. I think that if I was able to digitally emboss a paper to give it a tactile, like, texture to it and give it another dimension, that print would look cooler than a regular laser print. just like a screen print when it comes up off the page and has that texture on it, seems more impressive than a laser print.
Okay. Yeah. So while I was in this internship, there were some other interns, and we had some arguments because a lot of them did book art. And I'm not really a book artist, but they did art that was related to or about the book. And some of them made handmade paper, and they were really into that sort of thing. And we would talk about books a lot, and one of my main points is always that books, as we know it today, are probably going to disappear very soon. Like, certainly within my lifetime, but probably really, really soon. Like, physical books won't be something that people are trading around. And the main reason for that is that physical books are essentially tapes. Or are taking the place of tapes. And they're going to take that same path. And the digital book has so many more opportunities that paper books don't have. And there are so many benefits that it's just obvious to me that they will replace books. And they were really upset by that. And the reason they were upset was that they thought the form of art that they were interested in would go away. We were lucky enough to have Buzz Spector come. And he spoke at a nearby university, so we went and listened to him. And I was able to talk to him for a while. Buzz Spector is a really well-known book artist who does some really fantastic altered books. He does a lot of cool installations with books. One of my favorites is his library circling a room, and he lined his book up in height order around a gigantic room on a shelf that was exactly the same height everywhere. And since the books were just, I mean, he has so many that they were all like you can't really, if you just look at a couple, you can't perceive a height difference. But as you walk around the room, they get smaller and smaller and smaller.
Oh.
Really interesting. He does a lot of different book art. And we were eating after his talk, and I asked him, you know, what do you think about this transition towards digital books? And I didn't want to say, like, everyone knows books are going to be dead soon and digital books are going to be what everyone uses. But that was kind of my question, is like, well, how does that change your art? And I don't remember exactly if he said this or if this is what I picked up or the decision I made, but that strengthens book art because that adds a new kind of vocabulary to it, and it adds this new reason for making art with books. It doesn't ruin the ability to make art with or about that.
Well, I've been exploring this idea fairly unsuccessfully over the past 3 weeks, where I've been learning about the modernist painters who said, mm-hmm. why are we painting things that look like pictures?
Yes.
Why aren't we painting paintings that look like paintings?
Yes.
So why are we
That's like half of the history of art, everyone.
Yeah. So that's a very, that's a quickly summed up half of art.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
And so I'm looking at the books going, the book is a way of telling a story, just like a movie, yes. just like a digital book, just like a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't we looking at the book and start using the book as a book? Not as something to write my story in, not as something to write my notes in, not as something to be a window into a story. But to be a book. It's a little bit of an abstract idea. And if anybody has any suggestions.
On how to make that happen.
And how to make that happen. Or if they'd like to collaborate.
You could glue the pages together and cut the center out. And then keep your trinkets in it. Keep your valuables.
No, then it becomes a book about saving your valuables. It becomes a chest.
Yeah.
It's not a book anymore.
It's a safe.
And what is a book? What is a book?
What is a book? All right. So there's really high level abstract art in that. But my point is that art about books can still exist,
mm-hmm.
but physical books will soon enough not really exist as a thing.
I don't think you're going to live to see that.
I definitely will.
You can be hopeful
outside of this. Let's pretend that that's true, because it definitely is. But let's pretend that that's true.
I'm going to kill you in like 3 years, so.
Well, all right. Then maybe I won't. But even if that happens, which I'm pretty sure it will, but let's say, 10 years from now, you really can't go into a store and buy a physical paperback book or a hardcover book with paper pages.
I'm just wondering what we're going to do with all these paperback books.
They will still work. They'll still be, as effective as they are now.
Yeah.
Mixtapes obviously won't. like 10 years from, I mean, I already said you can't give me a tape because I have no way of playing it.
Yeah.
All right. 10 years from now, that will be even more true. And that's interesting because, like, I don't have a record player, but I know tons of people that do. And so it's an even older medium that still lives on. I don't think tapes will live on. Betamax is not going to live on. VHS will not live on. Hopefully DVDs and CDs will not live on because they're terrible.
Blu-rays.
Making a lot of Blu-rays too. Physical media in general is just pretty awful. There are some advantages to it though.
Physical media is dead.
Physical media is dead. Well, I mean, what do people mean when they say something's dead? Yeah, that's such a stupid point. Like I agree.
When is it alive?
Yeah, like paper is dead. Like, no, paper is not dead because it's not alive, and it's a medium for accomplishing some goal. And this kind of brings us full circle with what you're talking about from Simon Collinson, right? That, like,
yeah,
the web is not paper. Using web doesn't mean you're killing paper. Well, that's stupid because killing paper is not
a thing.
It's not a thing. What happens is you have some goal or some message or some story or some art, and you want to translate it to someone else. And the web is a better way, or digitally is a better way for almost every message you can encode than paper.
Except wedding invitations.
Right? But, like, there are some fantastic wedding invitations that are video. And video is a fantastic medium. There's also, because we're talking about weddings here so much, uh-huh. I got to talk about my favorite wedding invitation I've ever seen, which is this guy who hacked Super Mario World for the Super Nintendo, which is really common. There are level editors online so you can play it. And I think he went so far as to, like, actually load it onto a cart. So you'd play it on a real Super Nintendo.
Oh, wow.
And he and his girlfriend were playing it. And at the end of the game, when you beat it, there's, like, this section where you're running along as Mario. It's a 2D game. You're running along left to right. And in it, in coins, the developers had written, like, you win, you are a super player, which is awesome. You know, really heartwarming.
Nice. Yeah.
He went back and he just said, like, I love you, whatever your name is. You know, will you marry me? And, like, the recording that he had of it was kind of like a hidden cam. It was really well done.
Uh-huh.
That sort of thing is really cool. That's obviously a proposal, not an invitation.
Yeah.
But I've seen some awesome stop-motion invitations.
Yeah.
And I certainly have seen well-constructed emails.
Shut up.
Certainly.
That would be better than a nice printed invitation.
Well, there are advantages to it that I admire.
Shut up. Because you're lazy.
Well, no, it's not laziness. It's just it syncs up with my life. Syncs up with my life. So there is an element of art that gets lost with the transition from mixtapes to digital music.
But an element of art that is gained.
One of the elements of art that's gained is we get this awesome blog post from Chris about it. I really enjoyed reading it, and I don't necessarily think I disagree with him.
No, I do.
That there is some sort of art that is lost, but playlists are better in almost every single way.
And I think that, like we said, there's a certain element of art that's lost, but also a certain element of art that's gained with the, you know, public sharing.
Going back to your web.
But, Chris, you painted a far more beautiful picture of the art that is in mixtapes than Will or I could ever create about the art that's in playlists. Truly a man of words.
All right, this has been the White Horse Courier. Tom and I urge you to go read Chris St. Croix's fantastic post. He knows what he's talking about, and we don't.
Yeah. Read some other stuff he's got. It's really interesting. Watch that video. And look up some of those designers I talked about if you are interested in design.
Everything's in our show notes at verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier.
And you can get in touch with us by tweeting at me, at Tom Wixo.
Or me, at Will Imholt. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
Let your mountains dark and dreary be. When I am far away on the briny ocean toss, will you ever heave a sigh? nature seems to be at rest, but alas, there is no rest for me. Farewell, Nova Scotia, the sea-bound coast. Let your mountains dark and dreary be. When I am far away on the briny ocean toss, will you ever heave a sigh and a wish for me? I grieve to leave my native land. I grieve to leave my comrades all. My parents too, that I hold so dear, and the bonny, bonny lass I do adore. Farewell, Nova Scotia, the sea-bound coast. Let your mountains dark and dreary be. When I am far away on the briny ocean toss, will you ever heave a sigh and a wish for me? Captain calls, I must obey. Farewell, farewell to your Nova Scotia's charms. For it's early in the morning, I am far away. Farewell, Nova Scotia, the sea-bound coast. Let your mountains dark and dreary be. When I am far away on the briny ocean toss, will you ever heave a sigh and a wish for me? The sea-bound coast, let your mountains dark and dreary be. When I am far away on the briny ocean toss, will you ever heave a sigh and a wish for me? Will you ever heave a sigh?